Anurata Mittal is a native of India, and she's an internationally renowned expert on trade, development, human rights, and agricultural issues. After working for 10 years as the policy director and then co-director at the Institute for Food and Development Policy and Food First, she established the Oakland Institute last year. She's the author and editor of numerous articles and books, including America Needs Human Rights, The Future in the Balance, Essays on Globalization and Resistance, and Voices from the South, The Third World Speaks Out Against Genetic Engineering. Her articles and opinion pieces have been published in widely circulated newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Bangkok Post, Economic and Political Weekly, Houston Chronicle, and The Nation. Anurata has given several hundred keynote addresses, including invitational events from governments and universities, and has appeared on television shows and radio shows around the world. She serves on the board of several nonprofit organizations, including Polaris USA and the California Coalition for Fair Trade and Human Rights, and we welcome her to Radioactive and WERU today.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you for joining us. And I think the best place to start might be with the concept of food aid versus food sovereignty and how your group is involved with that.
Well, first of all, Amy, I'm really glad you are starting with this question. This is actually the title of a new report that the Oakland Institute has just published, Food Aid or Food Sovereignty. And it's a crucial time to be looking at this issue. A, most of the listeners might have seen on television or read in the newspapers headlines about severe famine in Niger. Almost 3 to 4 million people in Niger are starving, and the response has been to send food aid, which has been a delayed response. But the question that we need to ask is, what causes hunger? Most of us tend to believe that hunger is a result of shortage of food production, and that is a total myth. In fact, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization, we have enough food to provide over 2,720 kilocalories per person per day around the world. So the reasons for hunger are rooted in issues of injustice, of social inequities, of poverty, and dismantling of state intervention in agriculture. And that is why the concept of food sovereignty is becoming increasingly important and has to be the rallying cry for all of us if we want to really deal with world hunger.
So the response in Niger, and maybe we should talk a little bit more about that example, since that is one that you're using as an example of some of the problems and also what you think could be helpful. While there are several, obviously it's a very complicated issue, but the United Nations put out a call for food aid. There was a problem with even that being delivered, very little response and very, very delayed, and also the government there denying that there was a problem. And by the time some aid was starting to trickle in, people were starving to death. But you're saying that for long-term sustainability, we have to look at the problems that caused this to begin with, and it's not as simple as a drought as people would have it believed, or I think the next season there were locusts and different kinds of pests, that those kinds of issues that sometimes hit farming communities don't have to wipe out an entire nation's food system.
That's very true. It is indeed true that Niger was hit by drought and then by locusts. But if you look at the food production, it was only 10% less than the bumper harvest the year before. And when the appeals were first made last year, there was, as you mentioned, almost no response. And it was not till July this year that we have seen some movement in terms of food aid. And in fact, Jan England, who is the UN Humanitarian Relief Coordinator, said that the cost because of this delay had increased from $1 per child per day last year to over $80 per child per day. So first of all, when you think of food aid, our reaction tends to be this is a wonderful way of showing a benevolence, of being good neighbors, good community members in this globalized world. But the problem is that food aid initiated in 1954 has remained and continues to be a tool for promoting foreign policy interests as well as for promoting trade. It is really a way of dumping surpluses from countries such as United States and to assure, you know, markets for agribusinesses in the United States. And when this food is dumped in countries such as Niger, it brings the prices further down, which is basically destroying livelihoods of small farmers in countries such as Niger. If we look at what happened in Niger, and even Doctors Without Borders are stating that they are actually distributing food to people who are too poor to buy food in the market as a result of these international financial institutions such as the World Trade Organization, World Bank, IMF. Countries such as Niger have dismantled, for example, the grain marketing boards, which were responsible for providing support to their farmers, which were responsible for maintaining price control. Now, with them being dismantled, certainly the price of food is determined by the market, and there's black marketing going on where the food is being hoarded. So as Doctors Without Borders have said, we are distributing food to the poor people, and there is actually not the shortage of food production. So if we want to address issues such as world hunger, we will have to look at what we've done with the agricultural policies and sectors in countries such as Niger. It will require state intervention, the kind of state intervention we have seen in countries such as United States. If you look at the Farm Bill, the kind of subsidies that continue to be provided to the large agribusinesses, the way programs are created, such as food aid programs, to assure markets for them, that same kind of intervention is required in countries such as Niger so they can maintain their markets for their farmers. In fact, our research shows, which is using numbers from Food and Agriculture Organization, over 852 million people are estimated to be hungry in the world today, of which 50% are small producers. So we have created agricultural policies which are starving our food producers.
That was one of the more striking points in reading the report that that you all have published, and it's on your website, which we'll give later, that the small farmers are making up nearly 50% of the world's hungry population and are the hardest hit.
And Amy, the most striking figure for me is that some of the listeners might be aware of the fact that farmers in India have been committing suicide. Mm-hmm. And it is estimated that between 1997 and 2002, over 25,000 farmers had taken their own lives because they had gone into debts as they were told to kind of get on the treadmill of chemical fertilizers and pesticides. And when the crops were ready, there were no markets for them. So they were left in debt and very little choice left, and they took their own lives. But what is even more shocking for me is that the number one cause of death among farmers in the United States is suicide. So it is the same agricultural policies which are killing farmers in third world countries. The same policies are pushing our small family farmers in the U.S. to the brink as well.
Can you explain in layperson's terms, to some extent, I know it's very complicated, how these tariffs and subsidies affect the small farmer? I mean, it's basically an economics course to really try to decipher all of this. But at the WTO meetings in December, I understand this is going to be one of the big issues that's discussed, is the larger countries imposing these tariffs on imports and subsidizing farmers, and how that creates an imbalance with the other countries. So say you're a farmer in India or Niger, a small farmer, how exactly would that affect you if you were trying to either export something to the U.S. or import something from the U.S. or the EU?
So, okay, Amy, let's try it in layperson's language. So, for example, with the World Trade Organization, it is a requirement for countries to remove agricultural tariffs, which means that taxes that they might have had to, say, on a crop like corn, and if corn, you know, they're growing a lot of corn, they want to protect their farmers, so they would have taxes for corn that would come in from outside. But because of these trade agreements, countries have been forced to remove such tariffs. And at the same time, in order to create a level playing field, that every farmer has equal opportunity, that's what it means, a level playing field, you would have to remove subsidies. Now, in third world countries such as India or Mexico, thanks to the World Bank and IMF structural adjustment programs, those kind of support have already been taken away. But in United States, if we look at the last Farm Bill, 2002 Farm Bill, subsidies were increased by $180 million over a period of 10 years. So what happens is that here is the U.S. agribusiness. Now, please note, I'm not saying U.S. family farmers. These are not small farmers. These are large agribusinesses such as Cargill and Archer Daniel Midlands, who control over 70% of the world's grain trade. They are the ones who have the subsidies. So what happens is they can produce lots, and they are able to sell it to other countries at below the cost of production. So So if it costs, say, $1 to produce a bushel of, say, wheat, I'm just making up this figure, they can actually put it into India for, say, 50 cents per bushel. Now, given that kind of inequality, because Indian farmers will not have the subsidies, they do not have that support, they are not able to match that price, because if they match that price, there's no point for them to be growing those crops. So this artificially reduced prices, which are actually created by giving subsidies to large agribusinesses, you're able to take over the market in another country. Now, the result of that is that the small family farmers are being displaced from land, and as a result of that, it's a handful of corporations who gain control of a food system, because they are the ones who will then determine the prices, who will determine what is grown and how it is grown. So given that context, it is becoming impossible for family farmers to be able to stay in business.
So what happens if the talks collapse at the WTO in December and consensus isn't reached around tariffs? What would be the next step? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, the unfortunate reality of that is that agriculture is the carrot that was offered to the developing countries, that you can have market access, you need to earn your foreign exchange earnings, your expertise is in agriculture. So if you increase your agricultural exports, which you will be able to thanks to this liberalization of agriculture, that has become a stick for third world countries. So while there is no consensus, there's a lot of pressure on the European Union and United States to remove their subsidies and to actually create a level playing field. The problem is that both U.S. and EU have failed to provide a real timeline as to when and how these subsidies would be removed. As we start work on the next farm bill, you can already see that the Congress is very keen to maintain its subsidies, while the U.S. Trade Representative is lying to third world countries that, yes, we will remove the subsidies. Yes, we will lower the tariffs. So none of that has happened. But even while the consensus has not been reached, and we saw last time talks collapse in Cancun in September 2003, where the talks, the WTO ministerial was held, and now it will be in Hong Kong, despite that, the market has already been liberalized, and it's ongoing process. So if you look at the case of Mexico, thanks to NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, since 1995, when it was started, you find that almost 500 farmers are being displaced from land each day. So the liberalization of agriculture has already started. Third world countries have already made huge concessions, opening up their markets, thinking they would have market access, but that market access has yet to come. But the other important issue that I want to highlight, that it is not just about subsidies. It is the real question is about the recipe for development that is being offered to third world countries. That instead of supporting the small family farmers and maintaining their biodiversity, they are being told to focus on cash crops, to focus in converting their agriculture into trade and commodities by growing cotton or coffee for exports. But what happens then is that you're basically destroying your food sovereignty, your food security, and you're becoming dependent on other countries. In fact, Via Campesina, which is the world's largest small farmers movement, has said that they want market access, but they want market access to their own domestic markets, to the local region, instead of these promises of international market access.
So do you think that process is so far along of conversion to cash crops in some areas that they would not be able to convert back to growing more diversity and being able to feed themselves at this point, or that it would take several years?
Well, the question before us is that are we going to once again allow the third world countries to be really independent? Food sovereignty really means the right of countries and people to decide what to grow, how to grow, and to do it in ways which are ecologically, socially, economically feasible for them. So they would need the true independence to be able to decide that. You would need, instead of the dictates coming from World Bank and IMF, that countries are able to enact agricultural policies which can support their small farmers, which can maintain biodiversity, which can ensure grain marketing boards, their agencies that they have had in the past to be able to have, you know, distribution programs such as the entitlement programs such as the public distribution system in the case of India, or EDMARC in the case of Malawi. So those kind of institutions, it is very important, have to be maintained. And we have seen countries such as India or Zimbabwe and Malawi or Zambia, which have been faced with severe hunger. And when they found that food aid that was being dumped in their country did not respect the principles and the kind of food aid they wanted, they have started going back to those agencies to maintain food distribution and food security in their countries. So I think it is a failed recipe that has been given to the third world countries, and it is so unsustainable that it is bound to fail. But the question is, how many more people have to starve to death before we realize that? How many people have to die before we say that instead of food aid, and food aid which comes from, if it is in kind, which comes from U.S., how can we actually support third world countries to be able to create agricultural policies which will boost the food production by supporting small family farmers?
Do you have some answers to that question of how we can support that?
Definitely. I think the first thing is the USAID. U.S. is one of the largest contributors of food aid to the World Food Program. And I think it's time that we start advocating that instead of food aid being in kind, we have to allow for countries to be able to get assistance in forms of cash so they can put it into programs which would benefit their own farmers. Secondly, I think as citizens who are paying tax dollars in this country, we have an important role to play where we can actually contact our congressional offices and let them know that we do not want trade and World Trade Organization to have supremacy over our other rights, that it should not become an instrument or a tool of causing destruction to livelihoods of farmers around the world, that the trade deals that are being negotiated should be done in an open, in a democratic fashion, where third world countries are not being pushed against the wall and threats of cutting off aid or threats of making them join the axis of evil are not the way to kind of negotiate trade agreements.
What about just, I know you have more to say on this issue, but just a little side point, what about the debt relief?
Well, that's a very important part of the overall picture. I think when we talk about third world countries following the, you know, the dictates of the IMF and World Bank, debt has a huge role to play in it. This debt has been accumulated by third world countries, by the World Bank and IMF providing most often illegitimate loans for really bad so-called development projects, for building nuclear power plants, for building large dams which have displaced millions of people in countries such as India, China, elsewhere. So I think it is really about asking for the cancellation and annulment of these debts. We saw some talk of it at the G8 meeting in Scotland this year. But again, it was only to 18 countries, and it is a very pathetic deal which has been offered to these countries, and it is conditional. That is, the countries are only given some so-called debt relief if they agree to open up their markets further, if they agree to follow the economic model which is being promoted by the Washington Consensus. So that kind of debt relief is not going to bring any kind of relief to the people and the starving and the most vulnerable in third world countries.
So activists are looking at debt relief without conditions, without...
Definitely.
Right, okay. And were you, did you have some other ideas about what the alternatives are? I asked you a question. I think I kind of got you sidetracked a little bit.
Well, I think in terms of alternatives, I think each one of us can vote in many ways, starting in our own country. On one hand, as I said, we can contact our congressional offices. We can contact the USAID. And for more of that information, people can visit the Oakland Institute website in terms of action they can take. But secondly, it's about, we have to realize that food is both personal and political. It is personal because each one of us needs it to survive. It is not a luxury item. It goes right inside us each day. At the same time, when we reach out and pick something from the market shelf, we're making a political decision. So it is a result of this global trade in agriculture and global trade in commodities that we find blemish-free grapes from Chile, and we find all these things that travel long distances, which pay huge environmental costs to get to our market shelves. So I think while we are talking about food aid in third world countries, that people should be able to have food which is grown locally, it is the same principle that needs to be followed in the United States to be able to say that food and agriculture is not about trade in commodities. It is really about feeding our families and communities.
So if an individual wants to actually make some kind of contribution rather than... is there still a place for donating to some of the programs that are helping provide relief in terms of food in the short term while looking at these longer term solutions? You're not advocating don't make any pledges to this UN food relief, but do that and also look to the longer-term policy that's causing this problem to begin with at the same time, I'm assuming is what you're saying.
Oh, definitely, Amy. I think when we have a crisis situation, when people are facing starvation, we cannot ignore the role that organizations such as Doctors Without Borders have played. And I would urge people that if they do want to support and donate to a relief organization, I always personally make my donation to Doctors Without Borders. And what I like the most about them is that they always are very clear about one objective, that is they are not going into countries to start replacing the state, that they are there to provide relief immediately. But they also work at the policy level to be able to change policies that the states are able to play the role that they're supposed to play, that the governments are able to play the role that they're supposed to play. So I would definitely encourage people not to stop doing that, but at the same time, recognize that food aid and this kind of relief remains a band-aid solution, that we have to work towards a world where third world countries can be truly sovereign nations, which can be growing food and growing food not just for exports, but for feeding their own people and their own communities.
And you'll be representing the Oakland Institute at the WTO ministerials in December?
That's correct.
What will your group's role be there? Are there going to be teach-ins as well as there have been at some of these other large international meetings?
Definitely there are going to be teach-ins in Hong Kong, which are being organized through our World is Not for Sale Network and Hong Kong People's Alliance. But Oakland Institute specifically will also be working with trade negotiators from third world countries. Very often we find that while we have 500, 600 trade negotiators from, say, United States, some of the African nations actually have just one or a couple of countries come together to have one or two trade negotiators. And as the deals are being presented to them, as numbers are being presented to them, we provide them the support of being able to analyze that what the deal really means and what it really looks like. At the same time, since we believe in democratic participation, we will be providing from our website regular updates with the photo galleries to let people know as to what's happening, because World Trade Organization seems like an economic body that most of us don't have to deal with. It is left in the arena of economists and trade negotiators. But the decisions that are being made there are impacting our lives, our everyday life. So we want to ensure that people know how they can intervene, the pressure they can put, and to be able to create real global citizenry.
And you've said that you will join us again after that meeting to let us know how it goes and try to help us sort through some of the complicated issues and what comes out of that meeting in December.
Oh, definitely.
As well. Great.
Definitely. I'll be very much looking forward to that. And in fact, if I could give the website address.
Please do. And if you could say a little bit more, just, you know, as we finish up about what other issues Oakland Institute is involved in, so people know what they can find on your website as well.
Oh, definitely. Well, the report that I mentioned, Food Aid or Food Sovereignty, I would urge listeners to visit our website. It is available for download from there. And if you would like to purchase a printed copy, again, information is on our website, which is www.oaklandinstitute, which is one word, .org. So it is oaklandinstitute.org. And there are several programs that we have ongoing right now, and one of them is Aid Watch. Aid Watch is basically, doing research analysis. It is a clearinghouse which is monitoring foreign aid programs, and we generate reports, policy reports, as well as action alerts. So people are not just able to get information, but they can take action as well. And so I would urge the listeners to visit Aid Watch. At the same time, we have lots of work going on around biotechnology, the role of technology in agriculture, and how do we create a real democratic space for debate around what technologies are used. We also have on our website, Eyes on Hong Kong, and that website will be launched in next week, which would be presenting different statements, the proposals that are on the table, so people are well informed about what's going on as far as trade negotiations are concerned.
Great. Well, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again in a few weeks or in a few months.
Thank you very much, Amy.
That was Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute. And we received a call before we went on the air earlier this afternoon asking us to announce that Governor Baldacci will be holding a rally in support of equal rights and Maine Won't Discriminate here in Maine at the Courtyard Grill on Hammond Street, which is near the courthouse in Bangor. And that will be 2 o'clock on Sunday. And I believe we have a number here somewhere, but I don't have it handy for more information. But you can call me after we go off the air at 469-6600, and I'll get you that information.
Well, I'd hate to see the farmer was the last of a dying breed. Living off the land and taking what he needs. Don't see much for the future when a family can't survive. I'd hate to say the farmer was the last of his kind.
You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Joel Mann engineered today's program. Andy Buckley does web and technical support. You can reach us here at WERU or by emailing radioactive@mainindymedia.org. Our website is radioactivenews.org, and you can download programs there or subscribe to podcasting. Thanks for listening and acting, and please join us again next Thursday at 4 for Radioactive.